Chapter 34. He was, I know. I did not think one whom I called mine would grow up to treat me like this. He spoke to me as if I opposed him to injure him, as though I could wish him ill. There are worse women in the world than Eustacia Vi. There are too many better, that's the agony of it. It was she, Thomason, and she only, who led your husband to act as he did, I would swear it. No, said Thomason eagerly. T was before he knew me that he thought of her, and it was nothing but a mere flirtation. Very well, we will let it be so. There is little use in unraveling that now. Sons must be blind if they will. Why is it that a woman can see from a distance what a man cannot see close? Clem must do as he will, he is nothing more to me. And this is maternity, to give one's best years and best love to ensure the fate of being despised. You are too unyielding. Think how many mothers there are whose sons have brought them to public shame by real crimes before you feel so deeply a case like this. Thomason, don't lecture me, I can't have it. It is the excess above what we expect that makes the force of the blow, and that may not be greater in their case than in mine. They may have foreseen the worst. I am wrongly made, Thomason, she added, with a mournful smile. Some widows can guard against the wounds their children give them by turning their hearts to another husband and beginning life again. But I always was a poor, weak, one-ideaed creature. I had not the compass of heart nor the enterprise for that. Just as forlorn and stupefied as I was when my husband's spirit flew away, I have sat ever since, never attempting to mend matters at all. I was comparatively a young woman then, and I might have had another family by this time, and have been comforted by them for the failure of this one son. It is more noble in you that you did not. The more noble, the less wise. Forget it, and be soothed, dear aunt. And I shall not leave you alone for long. I shall come and see you every day. And for 1 week Thomason literally fulfilled her word. She endeavored to make light of the wedding, and brought news of the preparations, and that she was invited to be present. The next week she was rather unwell, and did not appear. Nothing had as yet been done about the guineas, for Thomason feared to address her husband again on the subject, and Mrs. E. Obright had insisted upon this. One day just before this time, Wilda was standing at the door of the quiet woman. In addition to the upward path through the heath to Rainbarrow and Miss Tover, there was a road which branched from the highway a short distance below the inn, and ascended to Miss Tover by a circuitous and easy incline. This was the only route on that side for vehicles to the captain's retreat. A light cart from the nearest town descended the road, and the lad who was driving pulled up in front of the inn for something to drink. "You come from Miss Tover?" said Wildov. "Yes. They are taking in good things up there. Going to be a wedding." And the driver buried his face in his mug. Wildov had not received an inkling of the fact before, and a sudden expression of pain overspread his face. He turned for a moment into the passage to hide it. Then he came back again. "Do you mean Miss Vi?" he said. "How is it that she can be married so soon?" "By the will of God and a ready young man, I suppose." "You don't mean Mr. Yobright?" "Yes. He has been creeping about with her all the spring. I suppose she was immensely taken with him? She is crazy about him, so their general servant of all work tells me. And that lad Charlie, that looks after the horses, all in a daze about it. The stun pole has got fond like of her. Is she lively? Is she glad? Going to be married so soon? Well, it isn't so very soon." "No, not so very soon." Wildov went indoors to the empty room, a curious heartache within him. He rested his elbow upon the mantelpiece, and his face upon his hand. When Thomason entered the room, he did not tell her of what he had heard. The old longing for Eustacia had reappeared in his soul, and it was mainly because he had discovered that it was another man's intention to possess her. To be yearning for the difficult, to be weary of that offered, to care for the remote, to dislike the near, it was Wildov's nature always. This is the true mark of the man of sentiment. Though Wildo's fevered feeling had not been elaborated to real poetical compass, it was of the standard sort. His might have been called the Rousseau of Egdon. 7 the morning, and the evening of a day, the wedding morning came. Nobody would have imagined from appearances that Bloom's End had any interest in Miss Tover that day. A solemn stillness prevailed around the house of Klim's mother, and there was no more animation indoors. Mrs. Eobright, who had declined to attend the ceremony, sat by the breakfast table in the old room which communicated immediately with the porch, her eyes listlessly directed towards the open door. It was the room in which, 6 months earlier, the Merry Christmas party had met, to which Eustacia came secretly and as a stranger. The only living thing that entered now was a sparrow, and seeing no movements to cause alarm, he hopped boldly round the room, endeavored to go out by the window, and fluttered among the pot flowers. This roused the lonely sitter, who got up, released the bird, and went to the door. She was expecting Thomason, who had written the night before to state that the time had come when she would wish to have the money, and that she would, if possible, call this day. Yet Thomason occupied Mrs. Eobright's thoughts, but slightly as she looked up the valley of the heath, alive with butterflies, and with grasshoppers whose husky noises on every side formed a whispered chorus. A domestic drama, for which the preparations were now being made a mile or two off, was but little less vividly present to her eyes than if enacted before her. She tried to dismiss the vision, and walked about the garden plot, but her eyes ever and anon sought out the direction of the parish church to which Miss Tover belonged, and her excited fancy clove the hills which divided the building from her eyes. The morning wore away. 11 o'clock struck. Could it be that the wedding was then in progress? It must be so. She went on imagining the scene at the church, which he had by this time approached with his bride. She pictured the little group of children by the gate as the pony carriage drove up in which, as Thomason had learned, they were going to perform the short journey. Then she saw them enter and proceed to the chancel and kneel, and the service seemed to go on. She covered her face with her hands. "Comma, it is a mistake," she groaned. "And he will rue it someday, and think of me." While she remained thus, overcome by her forebodings, the old clock indoors whizzed forth 12 strokes. Soon after, faint sounds floated to her ear from afar over the hills. The breeze came from that quarter, and it had brought with it the notes of distant bells, gaily starting off in a peal. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The ringers at East Egdon were announcing the nuptials of Eustacia and her son. "Then it is over," she murmured. Well, and life too will be over soon. And why should I go on scalding my face like this? Cry about one thing in life, cry about all, one thread runs through the whole piece. And yet we say, a time to laugh." Apostrophe, towards evening Wildov came. Since Thomason's marriage, Mrs. Eobright had shown him that grim friendliness which at last arises in all such cases of undesired affinity. The vision of what ought to have been is thrown aside in sheer weariness, and Brobyton human endeavor listlessly makes the best of the fact that is. Wildov, to do him justice, had behaved very courteously to his wife's aunt, and it was with no surprise that she saw him enter now. "Thomason has not been able to come, as she promised to do," he replied to her inquiry, which had been anxious, for she knew that her niece was badly in want of money. "The captain came down last night, and personally pressed her to join them today. So, not to be unpleasant, she determined to go. They fetched her in the pony chaise, and are going to bring her back." "Then it is done," said Mrs. Eobright. "Have they gone to their new home?" "I don't know. I have had no news from Miss Tover since Thomason left to go." "You did not go with her?" said she, as if there might be good reasons why. "I could not," said Wildov, reddening slightly. "We could not both leave the house. It was rather a busy morning, on account of Anglebury Great Market. I believe you have something to give to Thomason? If you like, I will take it." Mrs. Eobright hesitated, and wondered if Wildev knew what the something was. "Did she tell you of this?" she inquired. "Not particularly. She casually dropped a remark about having arranged to fetch some article or other. It is hardly necessary to send it. She can have it whenever she chooses to come. That won't be it. In the present state of her health, she must not go on walking so much as he has done." He added, with a faint twang of sarcasm, "What wonderful thing is it that I cannot be trusted to take? Nothing worth troubling you with. One would think you doubted my honesty," he said, with a laugh, though his color rose in a quick resentfulness frequent with him. "You need think no such thing," said she dryly. "It is simply that I, in common with the rest of the world, feel that there are certain things which had better be done by certain people than by others." As you like," said Wildev laconically. "It is not worth arguing about. Well, I think I must turn homeward again, as the inn must not be left long in charge of the lad and the maid only." He went his way, his farewell being scarcely so courteous as his greeting. But Mrs. Eobright knew him thoroughly by this time, and took little notice of his manner, good or bad. When Wildev was gone, Mrs. Eobright stood and considered what would be the best course to adopt with regard to the guineas, which he had not liked to entrust to Wildev. It was hardly credible that Thomason had told him to ask for them, when the necessity for them had arisen from the difficulty of obtaining money at his hands. At the same time, Thomason really wanted them, and might be unable to come to Bloom's End for another week at least. To take or send the money to her at the inn would be impolite, since Wildev would pretty surely be present, or would discover the transaction. And if, as her aunt suspected, he treated her less kindly than she deserved to be treated, he might then get the whole sum out of her gentle hands. But on this particular evening Thomason was at Miss Tover, and anything might be conveyed to her there without the knowledge of her husband. Upon the whole, the opportunity was worth taking advantage of. Her son, too, was there, and was now married. There could be no more proper moment to render him his share of the money than the present. And the chance that would be afforded her, by sending him this gift, of showing how far she was from bearing him ill will, cheered the sad mother's heart. She went upstairs, and took from a locked drawer a little box, out of which she poured a hoard of broad unworn guineas, that had lain there many a year. There were 100 in all, and she divided them into 2 heaps, 50 in each. Tying up these in small canvas bags, she went down to the garden and called to Christian Cantle, who was loitering about in hope of a supper which was not really owed him. Mrs. Eobright gave him the money bags, charged him to go to Miss Tover, and on no account to deliver them into anyone's hands save her son's and Thomason's. On further thought, she deemed it advisable to tell Christian precisely what the 2 bags contained, that he might be fully impressed with their importance. Christian pocketed the money bags, promised the greatest carefulness, and set out on his way. "You need not hurry," said Mrs. Eobright. "Tea will be better, not to get there till after dusk, and then nobody will notice you. Come back here to supper, if it is not too late." It was nearly 9 o'clock when he began to ascend the vale towards Miss Tover. But the long days of summer being at their climax, the first obscurity of evening had only just begun to tan the landscape. At this point of his journey, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.